Our second speaker is Kelly Podgorny. She is a project director at the Joint Commission in the Division of Healthcare Quality Evaluation, where she is the subject matter liaison for the Medication Management and Infection Prevention Standards. Ms. Podgorny has worked in quality management and accreditation readiness for over 20 years. She holds a master's degree in nursing science and management from Northwestern University and is certified in healthcare quality from the National Association of Healthcare Quality. Ms. Podgorny will graduate with a doctorate in nursing practice from Rush University in June 2011. We congratulate her for that because it's hard to do that kind of stuff when you're working full time. Her capstone doctoral project focuses on effective practices to implement the Joint Commission's Surgical Site Infection National Patient Safety Goal. Additionally, she is a co-author of the Compendium of Strategies to Prevent Healthcare-Associated Infections in Acute Care Hospitals, published in 2008. This document you can find on the Joint Commission or the SHEA, Society of Healthcare Epidemiology Association, websites. Lastly, she will discuss for us proposed revisions to the Joint Commission standard on influenza vaccination of healthcare personnel. Kelly?
Good afternoon, everyone. And on behalf of the Joint Commission, I'd like to thank Dr. Strikas for this invitation to speak with all of you. Okay. So for today's presentation, there's three objectives. The first one is that the Joint Commission's influenza vaccination standard for staff and licensed independent practitioners will be reviewed and that you'll be knowledgeable of them. That includes the current standard and also the revised standard. I'd like to talk about the plan for revising the influenza vaccination standard that's referred to as 020401, and then the barriers to the final vetting of the revised standard. And we certainly have some barriers and challenges that we've come across. All right, I didn't know how familiar all of you were with the Joint Commission, and we've gone through a lot of changes in the past few years. So I just want to take a moment to review our mission, which is to continuously improve healthcare for the public in collaboration with other stakeholders by evaluating healthcare organizations and inspiring them to excel in providing safe and effective care of the highest quality and value. And what you may not know is that the Joint Commission enterprise actually has four organizations or four components to it. There's the Joint Commission, there's Joint Commission International that is responsible for international accreditation, there's Joint Commission Resources that does our publications and conferences, and finally, our newest area, it's been open a few years now, is the Center for Transforming Healthcare. And this a new center was actually put together and started by our new president, Dr. Mark Chasson. The focus of the center is really the aim is to solve healthcare's most critical healthcare problems, and we're using the systematic approach of Six Sigma and Lean to do that. The solutions that we're coming up with are then going to be shared with the 18,000 healthcare organizations that we accredit. And if anyone is interested in learning more about the center, you can go to www.centerfortransforminghealthcare.org. All right, as we're moving into influenza, I'd like to just kind of to review with all of you the types of programs that the Joint Commission accredits. And the ones that are highlighted, critical access hospital, and long-term care, are the accreditation programs that currently have the influenza vaccination standard. However, if you look at the other programs, ambulatory, behavioral health, and we actually accredit 28 different settings in behavioral health, freestanding laboratories, office-based surgery, Medicare long-term, Medicare-based long-term care, and home care, none of those organizations that we accredit have the standard on influenza vaccination for healthcare workers. Let me tell you a little bit about why that happened. In 2005, the Joint Commission was working on the first version of the influenza vaccination standard, and it was published in 2006. The political environment in 2005-2006 did not support the standard being applicable to the non-24-hour settings. And several major issues came up from the organizations that we accredit, including, number one, mandating influenza vaccination. They felt that the standard was actually a mandate and did not want it to come across like a mandate. And then also having a signed declination form like the one Trish just showed, there's a lot of pushback about that. So we don't really have the concept of a signed declination form in the current standard. But this was a political environment in 2006, and we were really only able to get the standard authorized for long-term care in hospitals. So what I want to do right now is show you the current standard, and then you can see how you'll be able to compare it with the new standard that we've revised. So, and just as an FYI, the Joint Commission has several standards. We have standards on environment of care, medication management, infection control, et cetera, et cetera. And the standard is the principle that is being evaluated, but you don't really score against the principle. You score against what we call elements of performance, and these are performance expectations for each standard. So this standard reads that the hospital offers vaccination against influenza to licensed independent practitioners and staff. The first element of performance is that the hospital establishes an annual influenza vaccination program that is offered to staff and licensed independent practitioners. Secondly, that the hospital educates at a minimum about the influenza vaccine, non-vaccine control and prevention, and the diagnosis, transmission, and impact of influenza. So again, these are the expectations currently in place for this standard. Element of performance three, the hospital provides influenza vaccination at sites accessible to the licensed independent practitioners and staff. And then the hospital annually evaluates vaccination rates and the reasons given for declination. And the very last concept is that the hospital takes steps to increase influenza vaccination rates. When we were doing this past fall our assessment of this standard, the area that we thought we could really strengthen and improve are these last two elements of performance, EPs 4 and 5. So I'd like to take a moment to review the HHS draft action plan that was recently published. And this action plan has a component that is focused on influenza vaccination. The plan specifically focuses on the Joint Commission. It didn't really focus on any of our competitors that I could see. And it has a recommendation in it to encourage the Joint Commission to do three things: to extend the standards for healthcare professionals or personnel influenza vaccination to outpatient and other healthcare settings, to establish a performance measure, and then to establish a specific percentage goal. So out of those three, we are actually focusing on two that I will be addressing today. This, the whole issue about a performance measure, we've decided not to pursue that because we know that NQF and CDC are actually working on a performance measure, and Megan Lindley from the CDC will be presenting that information tomorrow. So we do have in a timeline, and I want to stress that this is a tentative outline and things could change regarding updating our influenza vaccination standard for staff and licensed independent practitioners. We did receive authorization last month to conduct a field review for all of our applicable programs on this revised standard that I'm going to show you in a moment. This is actually quite a big change from where we were in 2006, where we were only able to move forward with long-term care in hospitals. And when I say we're doing a field review, that's when we send the proposed standards out to our accredited organizations with a survey and ask them to comment on the proposed standard. So the field review is scheduled for April 4th through May 16th. Again, that's tentative, but I'm really planning to get it out sometime next week. Our Standards and Survey Procedures Committee of our board is scheduled to review the updates and any recommendations that we have in September of 2011. And so our earliest implementation is probably going to be about July 2012. And let me just take a moment to explain that. The Joint Commission has a policy that we always, for accreditation standards, we always publish them 6 months prior to their implementation date. So what we're really planning is to publish them in January or actually probably the fall of 2011, and so then they'll be out there for several months before they actually become scoreable, which would be in July. Any questions on that? Okay. So also, as part of our plan to update this, we've taken the revised standard, ICO 20401, and have reviewed that standard and its requirements with our professional technical advisory committees. And each of our programs, or sometimes a combination of programs, has committees of professionals and experts from the field, and they actually guide us on some of the issues that we're dealing with. We brought them the influenza vaccination standard, the proposed one, and frankly, hospital, critical access hospital, long-term care, didn't have a lot of issues. Most of the issues that came up were concerns that were raised from the non-24-hour settings. One of the issues that came up was that there's no evidence to support the standard in non-24-hour settings, and then also there was concerns about direct and non-direct care providers in behavioral health, in lab, and in home care. For instance, one of the issues that was brought up by lab is, do individuals who work in freestanding labs that are reference laboratories, who actually never see patients, they only see specimens, would this standard also be applicable to them? It's just an issue that was brought up. So what I'm going to do right now is show you the proposed standard. The standard is going to stay the same. We thought that was okay. And those first three elements of performance seem to be appropriate, and that we should keep them and not revise them unless we had to. Those two elements of performance, 4 and 5, that I showed you a few minutes ago, we're proposing that they be replaced by 6 new elements of performance. So I want to spend my time on those. The first one, the first new replacement EP, EP number 4, is that the hospital includes in its infection control plan the goal of improving influenza vaccination rates. And that's really important because once it's in the goal, let me stop for a minute. The Joint Commission requires organizations in the infection control standards to have an infection control plan. And so if we put the influenza vaccination standard, if we put requirements that go into the plan, then all the other standards in that chapter become applicable for that particular topic. So putting it in here strengthens the concept of influenza vaccination. Proposed EP5 is that the hospital sets incremental influenza vaccination goals consistent with achieving the 90% rate established in the National Influenza Initiatives for 2020. And just as an FYI, we actually spent a couple months trying to work the language out for this particular requirement. The issue is that we wanted to address these HHS's recommendation to us to actually put a goal in there. And we chose to go with the 90% rate rather than any of the incremental goals because we were told that those incremental goals in the HHS action plan could change. So we're actually now kind of working on what is going to be the best methodology to actually survey this with the field and with our surveyors. EP6, the hospital develops a written description of the methodology used to determine influenza vaccination rates. All hospital staff and licensed independent practitioners are to be included in the methodology for determining the influenza vaccination rates. And once that NQF and CDC performance measure is solidified and approved, we'll actually put a note on here to use as a reference for organizations. EP7, the hospital evaluates the reasons given by staff and licensed independent practitioners for declining the influenza vaccination rate at least annually. Number 8, the hospital improves its vaccination rates according to its established goals and at least annually. And the standard also is referred, has a link actually to our performance improvement chapter that gives more information about these concepts. The point that I want to make here with EP8 is this is really the implementation requirement that the organization has set goals. It has set goals to move toward 90%, and here we're saying that the organization needs to be making improvements in relationship to its goal. EP9, the hospital provides influenza vaccination rate data to key stakeholders, including leaders, licensed independent practitioners, nursing staff, and other staff at least annually. And this is very similar in wording to a requirement that we have in the HAI National Patient Safety Goals that are on CLABSI, surgical site infections, and MDROs. So there's alignment about the reporting mechanism required in those National Patient Safety Goals and here in EP9. And I just want to clarify that I've presented the hospital standards here, but the wording will be very similar for all the other programs that are going out for field review next week. So ambulatory will say ambulatory, behavioral health will say behavioral health rather than hospital. So what are our next steps? Well, we need to conduct this field review. As I mentioned, it's going out next week, and we're anticipating, you know, hearing more concerns and resistance from the non-24-hour settings. And then we're going to need to be providing recommendations to our SSP committee of the board on the proposed revisions, any new revisions that we're going to be making after the field review, and its application to all these other accredited programs. So I wanted to just take a moment to, review with all of you just a little bit more about some of the resistance that we're hearing about or the pushback. I don't think any of the programs think that getting the influenza vaccination for staff and licensed independent practitioners is inappropriate or wrong. There are just issues that they have to deal with related to it. The first one is the cost of the influenza vaccination program when the organization does not have an infrastructure to support that. That was actually brought up by, I think, our home care people and also in behavioral health and in ambulatory. A concern that was brought up last week was lawsuits against small organizations, the need for vaccination by staff who do not provide direct care. I've addressed that one before. There were special concerns that were raised by several of our accreditation programs regarding their rural organizations. And finally, the whole process for measuring the influenza vaccination rate is a concern, and I think Trisha's presentation illustrates some of the issues that occur with that. So before I end, I'd just like to say that the Joint Commission really feels like we need to really be working with the CDC on this, this whole issue of influenza vaccination for staff and licensed independent practitioners. We've taken the HHS action plan seriously and have tried to make revisions that support it, but we're really requesting the CDC support of the revisions that we're making and also getting some assistance from the CDC with the challenge regarding the lack of specific evidence for the non-24-hour settings. We'll be taking questions in a few minutes. I'd just like to thank the group that I'm facilitating that's working on this. As you can see, I have a pretty credentialed group of people working on this project. And finally, this is my contact information. So with that, Dr. Strykos, I'll end. That's fine.
So both presentations are open for questions. If you have a question or comment, please come to the microphone. Tell us who you are and where you're from, and ask your question or please make your comment.
My name is Diana Anaya McMaster from Washington State. And one of the questions I have, we deal with primarily inpatient or clinical settings. How do we address the immunization of pre-hospital personnel, firefighters, EMTs, first responders? Is there any work going on with that? And paramedics with all their work.
Did you include them, Trish? Let's pull that up to you towards
okay. I'm not sure. That's not something that I have a lot of information on in the work that I've done. That's a really difficult question for me to answer since I am not working in the hospital setting. I would venture to say that there are hospitals that are probably including some of those groups in their vaccination programs, but I'm sure there are a lot of hospitals that aren't. And I think that's a really good point. That's something that I actually hadn't really thought of. And I think that those are groups that we're going to have to consider as we move forward with our surveillance.
And again, just from a personal perspective, I'm the clinical and QA manager in Washington State, but in my spare time, I'm a firefighter, EMT, paramedic as well. And so,
congratulations.
And I spend a lot of time with volunteers who spend a lot of time in non-clinical settings with people in this day and age that don't have insurance. So their first call is always to 911, and we go into these homes. So talk about a group that doesn't want to be vaccinated. They're pretty resistant. So.
Yeah, that is a good point.
Question here.
Laurel Edelman with SDI. I actually have two questions. One is with regards to Kelly's presentation is, how are you going to measure the impact of moving from a, you know, vaccination rate of 47% to a vaccination rate of 90% in time and its impact?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that we're starting at kind of a low level with this because there really isn't even right now there's the performance measure from NQF that the CDC is working on with right now. But I can tell you there's an awful lot of questions out in the field on how to even do that measurement. So if you remember that element of performance that I provided, that they're having incremental goals to achieve 90% in 2020, that's really the element of performance that I think addresses your question. And one of the things that we have had some concern about is how do you actually then measure good or appropriate improvement? And actually, appropriate is a word that you don't ever see anymore, hardly in our standards, because it's very hard to measure. So what we want to do is have organizations develop goals that we can measure with them over time. So if in their let's say they have a survey in 2011 and their goal is 46%, we come back 3 years later and their goal is they've reached 50%, is that really an improvement enough moving toward 90% in 2020? So we haven't really worked all that out, but what we really want is for organizations to set goals for their own organization. We don't want to set them for them, but with the sense that they're going to be making improvements over time. And we have those two elements of performance in the proposed standard to do that. Okay. Does that answer your question?
It helps, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And Trish, just in terms of information back to providers, the healthcare personnel workforce is quite large, whether it's employee-based or non-employee-based,
right,
et cetera. Is there an exchange of the information back to their providers to document that vaccination?
Do you mean back to the staff and non-employee healthcare personnel?
Yeah, so basically, so I'm a nurse, but I go to a family physician, but I'm getting vaccinated in my employer setting, which just happens to be healthcare at this point. Is there a mechanism, you know, if we end up with 90% of healthcare workers vaccinated,
yeah,
tracking them as individuals in the community is also an important part of that?
Yeah, the CDPH doesn't actually do that, except in the way of the reports that Dr. Strick has mentioned and that I said are on our website. Those all show hospital-specific percentages. But in terms of individuals, since the data aren't reported to us in individuals, it's reported in aggregate, we don't have a way to share that information with providers. I guess that responsibility would be on the person receiving the vaccine. But again, you know, providers do have access to the report, so that would be the only way that they would be receiving.
But your standard in California does not require that the hospital or long, well, I guess it's hospitals,
just
mostly
hospitals
report that information to the healthcare providers of the employees. That's not their job.
No,
right?
Not in terms of this mandate. I'm not sure if there are other mandates. Not that I've heard of.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think there's a question over there.
Hi, this is Margaret Huffman. I'm with the State of Colorado Immunization Program. Thank you both for this really informative session. I got a lot out of this. This is a question for Tricia. I'm curious about your choice on the surveillance group that included physicians, advanced practice nurses, and PAs, and why that didn't include nurses.
Let's see. I think because a lot of the nursing personnel in California are registry nurses, and we felt that I think it was mainly because a lot of the nursing personnel are either registry nurses or they're employees, so we knew that many nurses would be captured in the paid employee group, and we also knew that the registry personnel for nursing and for some of the other, like respiratory therapists and those types, there's a little bit of a different system that we're trying to get hospitals to put into place that I didn't discuss in this presentation, but we're working on an attestation process or form or some kind of attestation that the hospital either requires that when they have the contract with the registry agency, that the hospital requires it as part of the contract, or that the registry agency provides an attestation. So we figured that nurses would be covered as the paid employees, and then when we add the registry personnel, then they would also be added in there. So that's kind of how the nurses
the distinction
come into it, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Hinman.
Yes, Alan Hinman from Atlanta. It's really nice to see people paying attention to immunization of healthcare personnel, but I wonder if you're not about to be overtaken by a tsunami, as there is growing sentiment and policy statements from professional associations and others advocating for mandatory vaccination of healthcare workers. Are you ready for that, or what are you doing to be able to measure that and issue standards around it?
Are we ready for the tsunami?
I just said, what was the question? I wasn't quite sure. Well, I think that the Joint Commission is already getting, you know, little pieces of the tsunami because we're getting a lot of resistance from the non-24-hour programs, that, as I have brought up. So I think that what I have said and what Dr. Strickas and I talked about last week is that the Joint Commission is really going to need help with this. We have all, as you said, you know, APEC, CDC, SHEA is all recommending that everyone get vaccinated. But then there is a sense that, you know, individuals should have a right to refuse even if there's a healthcare worker. So I don't think that the Joint Commission has all the answers for that, and we're going to need assistance from some of our stakeholder organizations to assist, because individuals do have a right to say no, but then the question is, if they say no, do they have a right to practice? And I certainly don't have the answer for that today.
Well, I think there has been a fair amount of discussion about whether, in fact, individuals have the right to say no, and there has been some distinction between people who are already on staff and new hires, because,
right.
in fact, instituting a mandatory policy is kind of changing the ground rules for existing personnel. But the number of organizations that are advocating for mandatory vaccination with termination for at least for new hires is growing rapidly.
Right.
And I'm astonished that you had the kind of improvement you did in California with just the declination, because it has not worked in most places.
Well, and I definitely agree, but as I said, there are many, many hospitals. I can't speak for all healthcare facilities, but for hospitals, there are many that are well below that. It's an average. So we do still have a lot of hospitals out there that are well under that 60%. And, you know, in terms of being ready for it, my sense is that in California, we're probably still a little bit away from having a statewide mandatory policy. This is the first time that CDPH has actually had a chance to really look at the data and see what's going on. And I think that we're getting a little bit of resistance from the unions in terms of having a mandatory policy. So it's probably going to be you know, a little bit more time before we have something official. But as I said, you know, we do have hospitals that I've spoken with. It's a small few, but we do have a few, and they're the ones that are pulling our rate up, I believe, since it's an average, that are looking at their influenza vaccination rates and really taking it seriously and deciding, you know, this mandatory sign declination is not what we need. We need something stronger. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones, like I said, that are getting their higher, over 80%. A couple of them had 90% vaccination rates. And I was looking at them and I was like, wow, these are really great. What are you guys doing? And that's what they told me. So.
Although at the same time, there are examples in the literature, and I know of one just up the road at NIH, the clinical center, where David Henderson is the hospital epidemiologist, this vaccine, in having a mandatory participation or declination program for 3 years in a row, they vaccinated 88% of all personnel in the institution. Now, NIH is a special place, but there are other places that can do it almost that well. And if the objective is to get to a point where you halt influenza transmission in the facility, then that's one step. Of course, the other steps are to try to assure the patients are vaccinated before or after they leave, and then what do you do about the visitors? And that's something we haven't even dealt with yet because it's easier to deal with the healthcare personnel. Although I agree with you, if you want to get to 95 or 98%, you've got to mandate. But if the objective is to stop transmission, and people argue 80% is good enough to stop transmission, at least in some nursing home settings and some studies, you could argue maybe we don't need mandates. So I think the issue is certainly there's a burgeoning tsunami out there, Dr. Hinman, but there are some people who argue you can do it other ways.
Well, there have been very few who have been able to get as high as 88% without a mandatory policy, and those that have initiated mandatory policies have typically, at least the few that I have seen data from, have been able to reach more than 90% of staff.
Yes, they absolutely do. The Virginia Mason, Barnes in St. Louis, and the Hospital Corporation of America, which has 197 facilities, and they've done it for all of them. And they're remarkable stories, and Emory is another one. Question here?
Nancy Gemeinhart with BJC Healthcare in St. Louis. And my question is for Kelly. From a Joint Commission perspective, how will you handle those healthcare facilities during their surveys who are well above 90% vaccination of their employees? Well, so they've reached your target.
Are you asking if we would be doing something special for them?
Well, would you have the same expectations? If their immunization rates are above 98%, are you going to still be looking for the continued improvement, if you will? That's described in the standard.
Boy, that's an interesting question. I haven't thought about that one. I think, you know, we're saying that they have to have a goal toward 90%. So we're not going to be actually evaluating them on the 90%. That element of performance is that they set goals that move toward that 90%. And then the I think it was EP8, really focuses on that. They're making improvements. So your question is, if they get to 90%, can they stop? And we would encourage them to continue moving in that direction. But I don't think that we would give, you know, like an RFI for an organization that didn't get past 90%. And just as an FYI, you know, these are proposed standards that are going out. And what we need to do now, once we solidify them and get the field review requests and then have them approved by our board, we'll, during that time, also really have to be working on survey process, which is another whole process to really determine how we're going to be evaluating them in the field. So I'm sorry I can't answer that 100% for you, but we would definitely, by the way that these new standards, this new standard has been developed and revised, we would be encouraging organizations to continue making improvements. I mean, do we not want to get eventually 100% of healthcare workers vaccinated?
Well, but I'm not so sure you can reach 100%, well, but I think 98.7% or above,
yeah,
is pretty,
I mean,
good.
100% without medical contraindications, I guess, is a target, but whether that's doable, I mean, 98 is, practically speaking, is pretty darn good.
The medical exemptions.
Yeah.
You know, there's a hospital actually in the Chicago area that's reached about a 98%, and they mandated it internally, and staff that refused, you know, needed to find, you know, work elsewhere. You know, so, you know, bottom line is that organization would have met the intent of all of the elements of performance, and then they would not get any kind of a RFI on that.